4-1, the remarriage of Jamie L. and Brent F. Van Boxtel. John M. Carroll, representing Jamie Van Boxtel, will proceed.
John Carroll, appearing on behalf of the petitioner, Jamie L. Van Boxtel. Justices of the court, the issue in this case is quite narrow. The Court of Appeals ruled in this case that a post-marital agreement that was entered into prior to a divorce being granted was a stipulation under 767.10 of the Wisconsin statutes. It's our position that the Court of Appeals was wrong in that regard. This was a contested two-day divorce trial that centered on property division primarily. It's our position that the three statutes that we've cited in our brief, in our petition, essentially the court's ruling would judicially amend 767.58 and 767.3L, the two property division statutes in question. The agreement in this case, Justices, essentially the Court of Appeals avoided the issue of whether or not this agreement was equitable or inequitable under these circumstances. So essentially that, without using my entire half hour, are the issues, and I think it's fairly narrow issues. I think that if the court moves beyond the issue of whether this was a stipulation, which clearly the trial court did not believe it was a stipulation, nor did either of the parties that were present, then we can get to the issue of whether or not this particular agreement was fair under the circumstances.
What's the difference between a stipulation and a contract?
Well, anyone, Justice, that has done any trial work knows the difference between a stipulation and a contract.
Well, you tell me.
Yeah, I mean, essentially it's used to avoid proof and make it simple for courts and juries to determine facts that aren't in dispute, where both parties are going to proceed based on stipulated facts.
You can stipulate as to damages. You can stipulate as to liability. It's an agreement. Stipulation is just an agreement. Maybe an agreement about particular things, but if you look in the dictionary, which I didn't do, a stipulation is just an agreement.
Sure. But in this case, Your Honor, I think that the way that a stipulation for any trial lawyer is what was contemplated in this case clearly wasn't a stipulation. Mr. Van Boxtel went into this trial not asking the court to enforce this agreement. He was repudiating his position at trial, is that he was asking the court to invalidate the agreement on equity, inequity grounds.
If we were to adopt the position which you're advocating, aren't there a lot of potential problems out there as people negotiate between themselves, and then they're also in divorce court? Doesn't that give cause for some potential difficulties? Just from a policy standpoint, not even looking at the harmonization or the comparison of these three statutes.
Actually, that's a very good question. I take the contrary opinion. In this case, this is a situation where typically a temporary order is issued in a divorce matter. There are temporary orders that are issued. In this case, the husband moved out, required the wife and three children to move out of the house. He refused to leave. And there were these two pieces of property that they each owned prior to.
I understand that. Right. But what I'm saying is that as a matter of course.
I don't believe my position. In fact, I think it would promote allowing the parties to agree among themselves avoids the need to go back to court to get temporary orders modified.
Well, here they didn't. I mean, this is the whole point. According to the facts, there was a disagreement as to what took place, and just factually, you had another lawyer who was outside of the divorce proceedings drafting this document, and based on all of the facts, it was a rather hurried affair because of the considerations do with the home sale and the purchase of one.
Right, but the respondent recognized that the petitioner needed a home because he was booting the other three children out of this home. And he recognized when he entered into this agreement that she was going to use it to finance this home. And it was only until the respondent's counsel decided that he was going to challenge it that it became an issue.
But what I'm saying, he didn't have a lawyer at that time?
No, he had a lawyer throughout the whole proceedings. In fact, she was unrepresented part of the time, and then trial counsel was retained. But the respondent was asked at trial if his lawyer would have allowed him to sign this agreement, and he said no. He said, I would have been stupid to sign it, essentially, is what he was asked. And he had 3 weeks, he was in his possession for 3 weeks between the time that the commitment letter and the loan was going to be approved, that he could have consulted with his trial counsel on it. So in response to your question, Justice, I believe that this kind of agreement in a situation where you have, and this case is somewhat unusual because there are two children in this, of the petitioners whose father was deceased and they were receiving income. Her entire income was from the deceased father's Social Security benefits. So these properties that were acquired was primarily through their income, and I think the Button case, one of the things that that case teaches us is that if the agreement that's entered into protects property of people other than the spouse, and in this case that would be Jason and Chantel Masterson, the stepchildren of Brent Van Boxtel, then it's more like it should be enforced. And so that would be my response to that.
How do these three statutes or agreements, written documents pursuant to these three statutes, interrelate?
Well, 766, I believe, is the general marital property statute, which applies to enforcing marital property agreements in other contexts. So it's cited simply for the purpose of it mirrors 767 in terms of when they're enforceable. So we're not saying that I believe that with this agreement, and I don't think they dispute that it is enforceable under 766, but we're simply bringing that to the court's attention because when one is researching this issue, these three statutes come to mind.
And well, you know, oftentimes in 760, a marital property agreement, a provision of marital property agreement can be in contemplation, obviously, pursuant to the statute, in contemplation of the dissolution of the marriage. I mean, so what I'm interested in knowing are what are the contours? How do they interrelate with regard to the purpose of the agreement and the timing of the agreement? When does one start and when does one stop?
I guess I'm not entirely sure of the question, but I'll try to answer that. Clearly 767 is 767 255 sub 3 sub L is the statute which is in question here. And that analysis is done whenever a trial court, first of all, they have to presume equal division. And the trial court in this case did not presume equal division. It went immediately into finding inequity.
Let me try it from a different point of view. Mm-hmm. 767-255-3L is binding upon a court unless the terms of the agreement are inequitable as to either party. A divorce stipulation under sub 10 is only enforceable subject to the approval of the court. But doesn't the approval of the court usually depend on whether or not the court thinks it's fair or equitable? And one part of my question then is, my global question was, how do they all interrelate? But let me attack it in a narrow thing. What's the difference between the inequity of 767-255-3L and 767-10-1? What makes one different than the other? What are the contours of one to the other?
Well,
one thing is, what do you need to enforce it?
Your response is, sub L, there needs to be a finding of inequity if it's not going to be enforced. Under a stipulation, if the court finds it's inequitable to either parties, the judge isn't going to enforce it. So what's the difference? What makes one animal different than the other?
Well, I think 767.10 sub 1 deals with a judge is sitting there deciding whether or not to approve a proposed marital settlement agreement. The marital settlement agreement referred to, I believe it was in the Ayers case, is the typical document that's submitted to the court for approval with the findings.
Yeah.
So the court looks at that and says, should I approve this stipulation?
And the court
says, in a very narrow sense.
And the court says, should I approve the stipulation? And the court says, well, no, I don't like it because it's the color red, and I won't approve it? No, that's not why he doesn't or she doesn't approve it. I won't approve the stipulation because it's upside down? No. I won't approve the stipulation because it's inequitable to one of the parties. So my question is, what's the difference between sub L and sub 10?
With regard
to enforceability or anything else? I want to flesh out the contours and the difference of these two things.
I think the difference is that after a disputed trial under 767.255.3 sub L, the court does that analysis to determine if whether or not the agreement is inequitable or not. And whereas 767.10 is simply there to tell the court that any stipulations that are going to be entered into this judgment and incorporated by it have to be approved by the court.
And if the court wouldn't approve a stipulation, what's the basis for the court not approving a stipulation?
For example, if there was a waiver of child support.
Okay. Why would the court say, why would that concern the court? Because it might not be fair?
I think that's the question involves too many different possible issues. If the court does not believe that the agreement can be approved for some other reason, I think it's a separate analysis than under sub L.
That's what I'm trying to get at. I want to know what it is.
What's the effect of filing of a divorce action on the party's ability to take any action regarding property that's in the marital estate? Once the parties invoke the jurisdiction of the trial court, the family court, under the family court by filing a divorce, isn't that typically thought to bring within the jurisdiction of the family court everything that is in the marital estate?
I believe, yes, it does. But on the other hand, these three statutes all contemplate these agreements being entered into either before or during the marriage. None of them preclude them being entered into while a divorce action is pending. So it's clear once the trial court has jurisdiction when the divorce action is filed, that these statutes do not, either one of them, don't preclude the parties to enter into an agreement with or without counsel as to the disposition of the property.
But doesn't 767.10 seem to indicate that any agreement, whether it's called a stipulation or agreement or a marital property agreement, that any agreement of the parties that divides or subdivides property that is in the marital estate at the time that the divorce action was filed has got to have the approval of the court?
I think that 767.10 is essentially a catch-all that the court looks at when deciding whether to approve a proposed stipulation or what we know as a marital settlement agreement.
It doesn't put any limitations on the party's ability to separately divide property under Chapter 766 or 767.255.3L?
I think it's just, no, I don't. I believe that 767.255.3 sub L, once the court has gone through that analysis on any particular property division issue and interpretation of an agreement, that this is just generic language under 767.10 that allows the court to either approve or disapprove of a proposed stipulation, not to determine whether a contract or an agreement is valid or inequitable.
Well, counsel, are you done answering that question?
Yes.
I look at these three statutes involved, and I say, maybe this is the same point that Justice Bradley was pursuing. What's the difference? You know, mox nix, since the judge can throw out any one of them if he or she believes that it's inequitable. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
So what is the difference here? When y'all brush your hair, all the smoke and the fire.
Well, the Court of Appeals never addressed the issues that we raised in the errors of law that we believe the trial court made. And so I know this court has those before it, but...
Well, let me put it to you, right? In terms of your case, the judge here determined in his discretion that it was inequitable. We will not overturn that decision unless that's erroneous, an erroneous exercise of discretion. It seems to me that you can lose, even if we find that this is a marital property agreement, or if we find it's a stipulation, or if we find it's a contract, or whatever, you still lose if we uphold the judge's discretion. So they all seem to be the same to me. I'm wondering what the difference is, and why is it important that we classify this as one or the other?
Well, I think if you follow the Court of Appeals decision to its logical conclusion, it means that you can never enter into a marital settlement, any kind of agreement for the division of property once your divorce action has been filed.
Well, isn't that, what's wrong with that? That's what I was getting.
Well, that to me seems contrary to common sense, first of all, and it promotes judicial inefficiency by requiring people to go to court over issues that they can agree upon.
They're in court now, and they're in court to get a separation. And involved in the separation is the division of property. So once the stamp of judicial involvement is there, that's the question.
Well, in this particular case, Justice, there was a temporary order of long standing, and she needed to get a home for her children. He knew that, and he allowed, knowing that this home that had been sold was all her doing.
Well, let me ask you.
Allowed it.
Would this have been better if they? And this is, of course, speculation. But in that situation you described, they could not have gone back to the court to have the court take a look at this right away.
We could have done that. Yes. That would have been conceivable.
What did the temporary order say regarding the party's ability to dispose of property in the marital estate?
I believe that the temporary order, it was a boilerplate language from Outagamie County, which just said there couldn't be any transfer of assets during the pendency of the matter.
Without court approval?
Without court approval.
Did it allow for transfer of assets upon consent of the parties without court approval?
I'd have to re-review the doc. I can't say, but I don't believe so.
Is it in the record? Do you know?
It should be, yes.
Mr. Carroll, is it your claim that Judge Desjardins here abused his discretion in finding that this agreement was inequitable?
Yes. And
what do you base that?
If I may, there was numerous, I think that some of his rulings that I'll just, there's a two or three points that he made. First of all, he found that the agreement was not enforceable because there was no consideration. So he did a contract analysis. So under 767-58, that statute clearly doesn't require consideration. That was one error that he made. In addition to that, if I may, with regard to this issue that Justice Bablich raised about the inequity, the court never made a finding. The first day of trial, after the court decided it wasn't going to enforce this agreement, he didn't make a finding of inequity. Lawyers went home. The night I was trial counsel in this case, and I spoke with the other counsel, the next morning, the first thing that he said to the judge was, by the way, judge, you need to make a finding of inequity here. And then he says, first thing out of the judge's mouth that morning was, well, if I have to use the magic words, I will. There was inequity. But he never went in to say why. If I don't enforce this agreement, Brent will lose $50,000 that he should have received, or at least to put some reason on why it was inequitable. Just using the magic words is insufficient.
So you're saying that the record does not review any exercise of discretion because it fails to indicate the basis of his discretion.
Right, so he had to be prompted in order to even use the magic word.
But I thought that the record, maybe I misread the briefs, but I thought the record made references to, and maybe this is just the lawyers or something, but didn't the judge make some reference to the fact that he didn't have a lawyer and he was feeling pressured and things of this sort?
I think the primary basis that he invalidated the agreement, from what I could see, was just the length of time that he had to review the agreement before signing it. And he picked up the petitioner at her residence and went to the bank to sign it. So I think that was really the only basis, rationale, that he used to find that it was inequitable. There was a notary present who notarized it. The lawyer was subpoenaed, who prepared the document. And I don't think he found the grounds weren't there for the three requirements, the three prongs that are necessary to make a finding of inequity. But the Court of Appeals didn't go into it. They just skirted the whole issue by saying it was a stipulation.
Well, if, when we write an opinion, we decide not only your case, but it decides cases yet to come, and it advises lawyers how to deal with agreements or stipulations or whatever you want to call it once a divorce is filed. So you've got agreements before marriage, which relate to what if there's a divorce. You've got agreements during marriage that relate to what if there's a divorce. You've got agreements at the end of a marriage, still married, no filing for divorce, but they're contemplating filing divorce. The agreement says, in contemplation of our divorce, we divide the property as follows. And then there's divorce filed, and then you've got another kind of agreement as here during divorce proceedings about division of one or more pieces of property, right?
Right.
Okay. And you fall into this last category. So what kind of opinion do you suggest this court write that deals with, after divorce is filed, the parties make an arrangement, an agreement, about one or more, maybe the whole property division. What rules shall apply? Now, you've got three choices that you've said. One, 767.101, which says if there's a stipulation in a divorce about property division, it's subject to court approval. And there's nothing said here how the court should approve it. Maybe that's all covered under 767.255.3L. That deals with agreements before or during marriage. Now, they're still married when they're in a divorce proceeding, and that deals with inequitable, okay? And you've got 766.58.6 that says a marital property agreement is enforceable. In fact, under 766.58, a marital property agreement is viewed as presumed equitable, isn't it? A marital agreement, and then is not enforceable against whom it's done unless they prove the following elements. So now, one or more of these can be the basis of our decision. So what should we say? That would be the rule for all trial courts, courts of appeals, and parties. So what should the opinion say?
I think what we're asking the opinion to be is essentially that, first of all, that the Court of Appeals was dead wrong, that a stipulation under 760, this is not a marital agreement that is contemplated and cited, this agreement cites 766 and 767, and it's meant to apply to that. But what we're asking you to do is issue a decision that clarifies that 767.10 is not a catch-all which can be used to just, by terming these documents stipulation, turn them into stipulations when in fact they are contracts. And in terms of the analysis, I think the case should be remanded to the trial court, perhaps for additional findings on inequity if the court doesn't feel that there's a sufficient record.
What are we going under? You don't want to go under 767.101. Is this a 766.586 marital property agreement?
Yes, the agreement was drafted and it complies and it's enforceable under that, but the appropriate statute is 767.255.3L.
Okay, and that relates to a written agreement made by the parties before
right.
or during the arrangement.
And that contains the presumption.
That's
by the way,
right.
The trial court in this case never overcame the presumption at all.
Now, the relationship between 766.586 and 767.255.3L is that parties, while they're before or after marriage, can divide their property and it will be presumed okay, unless it fits within the subdivisions. But on equitable distribution relates to the entire property, and the court is not bound by the party's agreement for marital property. That's what L means. It means that they can overturn it, but it has to be equitable.
Sure. But in
you
this
want to case, go under that.
Right. But in this case, this was a limited marital property agreement. It was limited to one piece of property, the one purpose for it was to get these children into a home while the case was pending for 3 years. And it was not the type of general agreement that covered all the types of issues that you see in a divorce case. It was just for that one limited purpose. So the statute is sub L that I believe is the one that the court should proceed under here.
So you want to go into 3L and you want to remand for determination of whether it's inequitable.
I thought you wanted to go under marital property.
I'm sorry, Justice, I didn't hear it.
I thought you wanted this court to hold that this was under the marital property agreement. Not under 7-6. I thought you wanted us to find that this was under 766 rather than 767-2553L.
Well, I'm essentially just citing 766-58 because that provides the basis for which marital property agreements in general are enforceable. Mm-hmm. But the more specific statute in this case is the divorce statute,
okay.
which presumes equal division. But I just cited that because I thought it was important because it essentially provides the same basis that 767 does.
Chief,
ma'am. Thank you. Justice Brownlee has a question.
Counsel, sub L starts with any written agreement made by the parties before or during the marriage. Does that language include a marital property agreement drafted under 766?
Yes.
So it's not referring to some other kind of agreement that may not have followed the requirements of 766. It's referring to a 766, is it referring only to a 766 marital property agreement, that language?
I don't believe so, no. What I believe 766 refers to is any time where parties want to alter the marital property law in general, just for any reason whatsoever. They want to somehow alter the distribution that would take place under 766 in probate or wherever, in whatever setting it was in, or in the creditor situation. 767 is the divorce property division statute, which presumes equal division. They're two separate statutes. But 766 simply tells you what you need to do in any situation where you want to alter the effect of the Marital Property Act.
Chief, may I ask a little bit about that piece of property on Walter Avenue?
Sure.
This was a house?
Yes.
It was acquired how long before the marriage?
Walter Avenue belonged to the petitioner, I believe, at least 5 years before the marriage. I'm sorry, 3 years before the marriage.
And did I understand you to say in argument that this house was acquired from assets that came out of the death of Jamie's former or late husband?
Well, it came from the income that was generated by his death, and that was, so essentially it was property that was acquired as a result of the children from the prior relationship, the deceased father's Social Security income.
Okay. Is that all in the record?
Yes, it is.
Is that then subject to normal property division, or is it an exception to normal property division?
Well, the Walter Avenue property was sold, and I believe that the property was sold during the marriage. And so what the judge did here is the respondent's property was sold, the James Street property. What he did was he said that was a wash. The petitioner, the respondent, had $14,000 in debt. He didn't even include that in the property division. He didn't enforce the agreement, and he said the $32,000 that was realized in Walter Street she wasn't going to receive that offset in the ultimate property division. And so then Brent kept the Norrose Lane property, which just had been built, and which I understand he recently sold. So essentially, she walked away with nothing, is what happened here. So the agreement on the Walter Avenue property was clearly acquired prior to the marriage, and I think the agreement in question recognizes that, which the court found was inequitable.
Has a final property division been entered here?
Actually, while this case has been pending, he was in contempt, but he recently paid what the court ordered. He hasn't paid the interest, but...
But has there been a final judgment here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And divided this property and other property?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
It pleases the court. My name is Dave Van Leeschout. I'm an attorney with Men, Teetard, and Weisenstein, Little Chute office, Little Chute, Wisconsin. I represent the respondent in this case, Brent Van Boxtel. And essentially, it's our position in this case, as I set forth in my brief, that the simplest way for this court to proceed is to say that once you file an action for divorce, any document that is executed by the parties is not a stipulation as that is understood under 805.07, but it's a recommendation to the court. And as a recommendation to the court, it can be repudiated at any time prior to approval by a court. And a court is an integral part of that process because the court has jurisdiction. And I think that if you're looking at all of these statutes together, what you look at is the difference is that this was done, in this particular case, after the divorce proceedings were initiated.
What about the Ayers case, which I understand to say
it can be done before divorce, but in contemplation of divorce.
I don't think that, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Justice. I don't think that that should be what this court should do. This court should give guidance to everybody in this state that we aren't going to get involved in these types of quicksand arguments that we saw here when the petitioner was talking, where, oh, how long did you own that property? Who got it? Those are things for the trial judge to do. And when you get in front of the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, you're listening to arguments and you're making law that applies prospectively for other people as well as to the people that are involved in this case. And what you look at is say, we're not going to get involved in this issue as to what's the timing on contemplation. Is it 3 months, 3 years, were they contemplating shortly? I think you say, forget about that type of argument. We want everybody to know from this day forward, if you file for divorce, 767-10 applies. If you haven't filed for divorce yet, you're contemplating it, 767-255 applies. If it's just a general marital agreement at the beginning of a marital relationship, 766.58 applies. If you do that, you bring simplicity to the situation, you bring judicial economy. I don't think that there's really a whole lot of difference in looking at what your analysis in terms of why do you enforce an agreement? Why do you enforce a recommendation? If I recommend to Justice Sykes that this is good, she's going to make a determination as to whether or not that's fair or not. Is he being fair? Is he being equitable?
Counsel, it seems to me that the practical, tell me what the practical effect and practical differences there are, because a judge can throw out any one of the three if the judge finds that it's inequitable or unconscionable.
The practical difference is when you're before the court makes the decisions. That's the practical difference. When you file for divorce, you say to the judge, you say to the courts in this state, you're the ultimate person that makes these decisions, as opposed to us making it and coming in and we having to have a bunch of testimony as to what were the circumstances as to how it was signed, whether or not there was consideration, how much time was there to review it. If you say to people, once you file for divorce, you can make recommendations to us, and then we're going to evaluate those recommendations based upon not how you entered into this agreement, but based upon whether or not it's fair to everybody. That's the practical difference. How many hours were probably spent in this case? I wasn't trial counsel. How many hours were spent on who drove over to the bank to sign the agreement? I mean, that makes no sense to me. It doesn't make any sense to me that you'd sit there and argue about that in front of a trial judge. I would say, hey, judge, I owned this property before I got married. I've paid for it with Social Security payments from my deceased husband. That should be mine. Well, let's look at everything together and see where we end up at the end of the day, not whether or not I force somebody to sign something. That's not what we should be paying judges to do. The judge in this case, I can't believe the judge discharged, as long as I've known him, would make a decision where somebody walks into a deal and ends up at the end of the day with nothing. I think he looked at the whole circumstances here and said, it's not equitable to enforce this agreement on a kid that signed it when he was pressured. I mean, that's what the judge decided. It's just not right. If the judge thought it was right, don't you think the judge would have enforced the terms of the agreement, even if the agreement itself he found invalid?
Well, let's just go back to the statute if I can. 767.10 says, that's the one you want us to...
That's right.
Okay, so you view this as a stipulation.
I view it as a recommendation, a stipulation under this law as opposed to a stipulation under 80507.
Okay. Under this law, to use this terminology.
Right.
Since we're stuck with this terminology.
That's correct.
The parties have, when you say stipulated, that means they've agreed, right?
Yes.
Okay. So they've agreed for division of the property. And then it says that... subject to the court approval, right?
Correct.
Where are the standards for the court approval?
I don't think there are any other than equitable standards.
Well, The standards have been set forth in the cases, which probably are can be summarized in equitable. So the court will approve this or not approve that. That's what you want us to say, and you want it to go under the standards of the
standard. Yes, that's correct, Justice. The standards are, I mean, almost all standards come down to equity in one form or another when you talk about property division.
There are two kinds of equity, for simplicity's sake. One is in the execution. Were the parties represented? Did they make fair disclosure? Did they? Was there undue pressure or coercion, etc.? And the other one is fairness in the substance, that is, in the terms, equity in the terms, right?
That's correct.
And the judge here could have considered both.
And I think he probably did.
Okay. And that would be if you use that discretion. If you go under 767.255.3L, that, in effect, says that if there's a written agreement before or during marriage, and you would say that only means up to the filing of the divorce.
That's correct.
Is that right? There's a presumption that it is equitable, although the court can throw it over as inequitable.
Yes, I think that where the cases in trying to delineate a difference or try to marry all of them together have said 767.255.3 is the button case where you did this at the time you executed, at the time you got married, and you were doing it in anticipation of bringing some type of where everybody's getting along and everybody wants to look at it as the best possible way. You don't contemplate divorce. Now all of a sudden you're getting divorced. Okay, is it still fair? That's 767.255.3L.
And that covers what might be a marital property agreement or might not be a marital property agreement.
It doesn't necessarily. Yes, 766.58 could be included in that, but it's not the whole universe of that statute.
That's right, because 766.58 are marital agreements. Marital property agreements need special things before they might be denominated marital property agreements under Chapter 766, right? Full disclosure, statements, etc. So you can have agreements as to division of property that aren't marital property agreements.
Well,
is that right?
I don't know about that. I think if you're coming under 7, you can under 767. I think under 766, if you have an agreement, it's either a marital property agreement or it's not enforceable. If you're married, you have to comply with 766.58 to have an enforceable agreement.
Well, is this enforceable under 766.58?
No, and that's what the trial judge ruled in this case.
And he said that. Okay.
Because he found it was unconscionable under the circumstances of pressure upon one party to execute the document.
Right. Now, in this property division, do you agree, and was this two parts, one do you agree and two was it handled at the trial court? Under 767.255.2, the general rule on marital property, on division on divorce, is one half of property goes to each of them, subject then to changing.
Correct.
And one of the considerations in terms of what you put into this estate for equitable distribution on divorce is you do not put in proceeds that arise from the death of another. Or
yes.
Gifts, right. Right? That's 2, 1, and 2, right?
Correct.
And this appears, from what we've heard today, to fall into 1 and 2.
I don't know that it does or it doesn't. I wasn't the trial judge or trial court attorney in this case. I'm going on the basis of my understanding that the judge made his decision that he divided the property fairly and under the law.
Did he consider those? You don't know.
I don't know that.
It should show in the record.
If it does, I haven't seen it. But I am not aware of that. I have not looked at that specific issue with regard to this agreement.
Counsel,
Are you done?
Yeah, I'm done.
If this court should find that the judge did not erroneously exercise his discretion in finding that this was an inequitable, it doesn't make any difference to you, really, does it, from a practical standpoint, what we label the agreement, whether we put it under 767 or 766. So long as we uphold the judge's discretion, you win, right?
Correct.
Well, it seems to me that that's what you should be arguing. At least I'd like to hear a few minutes on why did the judge correctly exercise his discretion? And is it found in this record?
Well, I believe it's found in this record in the sense that the judge indicated that the circumstances that led up to the signing of this document indicated that there was pressure upon my client to execute the document.
Which the judge said that?
Yes, which he later repudiated and felt that it was unfair to him and that his attorney would have advised him not to sign that. Mm-hmm. And I think that the judge, the record reflects that information. I look at this as a situation where it's inequitable for this agreement to be enforced, and there's enough in the trial court record to approve or uphold that decision.
And if we find that, then you don't care whether we call it a marital property, we call it a stipulation, or we call it an agreement, right?
It doesn't make any difference to me, except that in this particular case, the trial judge makes a determination that it's a marital agreement and that it's unenforceable because it's inequitable or unconscionable. The Court of Appeals then turns around and says, well, you took the wrong car, but you got to the right place. It's really a stipulation, and therefore, we're going to throw it out for those reasons. So I'm saying, if you folks want to take a look at it, I would, if I'm going to win, I think it would be better for everybody in the state of Wisconsin that after you file for a divorce, it's a recommendation, and you don't do this. So we don't have this happening again. But for me, for my client, he doesn't care how you do it. He thinks that he should win because it's inequitable.
Could I ask a question? I think your position is that a marital property agreement cannot be executed after a divorce proceeding begins. Is that right?
I think that's ultimately what the decision, I think that's correct.
And I think that's quite a logical position to take. But where do you get that from the statute?
I get that from the statutes in that 767.10 specifically says that if there's a filing of divorce, there's an action, if there's parties to an action for divorce, any stipulation, which is essentially a contract, is... is subject to court approval. A marital property agreement is basically a stipulation between the parties to a marriage as to how their property might be divided, what happens upon the death of one of them, what happens in the event of divorce. And I think that if you want to read all these statutes together and you want them to make sense, you say that once you file for a divorce, this is the law that applies.
Counsel, that sounds awfully nice. But I think it requires us, and respond to this, to overrule Ayers, to withdraw, overrule some language from Ray, and maybe Abbott's. I don't know. If I recall in Ayers, you have the case where the people decided to get divorced. They drew up this contract. They called it a contract. They signed it after they decided to get divorced, but before they filed the divorce. After the divorce was filed, one of the parties withdrew their consent. And the court then said, this is an agreement made in immediate contemplation of divorce. And so we're going to treat that as a stipulation, too. And my recollection of language from the Ray case and the Abbott's case deals with the same thing. So although your bright line is awfully attractive,
Does it require us to overrule those cases?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
If you want to make sense out of the way this all works, isn't that what you ultimately have to do? If you look at this, if you want to get out of this morass of the issue as to the timing on contemplation and all of this stuff, apply 767-255-3 to any case involving marital property agreements before the initiation of divorce, and it makes it easier on everybody, including people like me, who sit in the trenches in Little Chute, Wisconsin, and have people ask these questions all the time. I deal with people on a daily basis that come to me in my practice and say, I'm getting married for the second time, I got this thing.
You know what? I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, I have these issues. What happens if I get divorced?
You know what I'm going to do if I have money and am manipulative and am going to get a divorce? I say to my unwilling and unsuspecting spouse, hey, let's get a divorce. Let's agree to this. And let's say that the spouse agrees to things maybe under some pressure or under some duress or under some sense of guilt. Okay, this is agreed to, and boy, did I ever win on this one. You know, I mean, it stinks, but I got him to sign it. And then the next day, I file for divorce. Clearly, and even the document might say, we are signing this document in contemplation of the divorce. How do we take care of that kind of situation?
I think that the analysis that is in the Button case would be applicable to analysis in that type of case. What's the difference between that? I mean, the Button case is a case where circumstances changed, and as a result, it was unfair. Now you have a situation where you're saying you're defrauding somebody, and you're treating them unfairly, and then you're going to go into the court and get the imprimatur of the trial court to approve it. I think you'd go in there, and they'd basically tell you that you're all wet.
The chief, I think, asked this question, but let me make sure. Is it your position that every agreement signed by married people prior to filing divorce that deals with even an issue of property division is a marital property agreement?
Prior to the divorce proceedings?
Yeah.
I think so, yes.
And
if you're married, sure, it has to be.
No. Well, I think the question is, Justice Brantley, whether it falls under 766.
That's what I was using that as a term of art.
Okay.
Yeah, as a term of art. Is it a document under 766?
Absolutely.
Now, what has to be done under 766 to comply with 766 to make it a document under 766?
Well, there has to be, there's a list of statutory requirements. Full disclosure of assets has to be fair, cannot be unconscionable. I mean, at the time it was executed. The parties have to be residents of the state of Wisconsin.
So if I just have one, this ring, I really like this ring, it's my grandmother's ring, and I want my husband to sign just about this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You have it, you'll always have it, and maybe even there's some consideration or something. Anyway, just deals with that.
Right.
And that was done before the divorce was filed. That would be a marital property agreement under 766.
That's correct. And it would be subject to the rules and regulations after the divorce proceedings if they were instituted under 767.255.3. And, you know, this single issue area that the petitioner brings up has been tried before by people where they say, well, we're only dealing with one issue. But that one issue could be the most critical issue in the marriage. It could be one piece of property that means more to you, your ring, than anything else. And it may not have necessarily, at the time, a lot of value. I remember one of the cases in contracts law in law school where these guys got the people to sign over their rights to this mining stock. Well, mining stock was worthless for the most part. They returned it for eggs and bacon. It became valuable when they hit the Comstock loan. Things change. Values change. Circumstances change. What you have the ability to do here is to take all of these things and make sense out of them at the end of the day.
Counsel, I have some sympathy for your position, if it's based in fact. As a private counsel, you're asked these questions every day, and we can straighten this out. What if I'm the lawyer, I'm your underling in your office, what's wrong with me saying in response to those questions, look, Mrs. Smith, it doesn't matter whether we label this a marital property agreement, or we label this a contract, or we label this a stipulation. It doesn't matter if we cite the statutes. So long as it is fair, it is not unconscionable, it is not inequitable, and there's been full disclosure, it's going to pass muster on any, under anyone. Why can't I answer that question that way?
Well, you know, as a practical matter, that's, you know, the question that people ask me and the question that you're asking is it fair? It's a question of timing. And it's a question of when is it fair?
But if I...
And the answer is the same under either one. It's just a question of if they come to me and I say, but if you get divorced, understand that it's only a recommendation to the judge. And it doesn't get enforced. It's not an agreement yet until he approves of it.
Oh, I understand. I understand all those legal technicalities and all that.
Well,
but
there's a
difference. So long as you can show that it's fair and it's equitable, it's not unconscionable, and there's been full disclosure.
I think there's a big difference in a practical sense between the two, and that is that when you go into court and you have an agreement, and the judge says.
An agreement under what, 767?
Under 766, you're going into, you sign under 766-58, now you're in divorce court, mm-hmm. and he's looking at it, or she's looking at it under 767-255. I'm a judge, I look at that and I say, well, looking at the circumstances, it might be a close call, but I'll let them do it the way they wanted to do it when they did it before they came to see me. But if we do it after the divorce, then I'm going to look at it more with a sharp pencil to make sure that I'm protecting the principles of the policies that have been delineated in 767. I think there's a big difference. There would be to me. Well, if you people think it's fair, okay, I guess I'll go along with it. But once you come into my courtroom and you do it after you file for divorce, listen, I sign off or you don't get anywhere. And that makes a big difference to me as a practical matter, day to day, in the way I practice law. If I can tell people they don't have to worry about it, that it's a difference between a recommendation and agreement, means a lot to me.
What about 767087, which talks about what actions are prohibited during a pendency of a divorce proceeding, and it says that. You can't encumber, or conceal, or damage, or destroy, or transfer, or otherwise dispose of property without the consent of the other party or an order of the court. And that is memorialized in the temporary orders that are entered, typically.
Right.
That seems to imply that the parties can, by mutual consent, enter into agreements during the pendency of the divorce. Regarding the transfer or disposal or encumbrance of property that's in the marital estate.
I don't think it does, in the sense that 767.10 trumps everything else in that statute. If you say to me that you can go ahead and you can do what they did without court approval, I don't think you can. I don't think you can read that statute to allow for action to be done without court approval.
Well, it's written in the disjunctive. It says you can't do those things without the consent of the other party or an order of the court. So that seems to imply that if you can't get consent, then you got to go to the court. But if you can get consent, you can do it.
Well, it's limited to secure necessities or pay reasonable cost expenses.
No, that's the exception, I think. Right?
Well, no, except in the usual course of business. Mm-hmm.
That's the exception.
Right.
So
I don't have the statute in front of me, Justice Sullivan.
It says it can't do any of these things without the consent of the other party or an order of the court, except you can if it's, you know, buying groceries or something like that.
I don't know. I would try to read the statutes together, and if you can't enter into an agreement without approval of the court, and that's one of the first things it tells you in that chapter, you better get approval of the court before you go out and say that you're waiving your rights to any proceeds from the sale of this house.
Well, I'm trying to reconcile the two, and they don't reconcile, because this says that you can do these things to property that's within the marital estate if you get consent of the other party. The temporary order that was entered in this case essentially echoed that at paragraph 24. It says both parties are restrained from encumbering or disposing of assets or property, et cetera, except upon written agreement of the parties. Doesn't say you have to come back to court for an order if you want to do any of those things. Now, perhaps there's a difference between an agreement encumbering or disposing of assets or property and an agreement that divides property in the marital estate or waives a right to property in a marital estate. Maybe that's the distinction.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that if you have an agreement that you can sell the house, but I'm not waiving my rights to one half of the proceeds from that, and wherever it goes, I get half of that, I don't have a problem with that. But if you're telling me that if I sell it, then I lose my interest in it, then you better have a judge approve it before I agree to it and it's binding on me. Those are the only arguments I have. Thank you very much.
Let me just ask. One of the things I'm concerned about, let's say someone drafts a marital, and maybe it's just because I forget the button, I haven't reread that, but let's say someone drafts a marital property agreement, and it complies with all the button requirements. The independent counsel, there was full disclosure, they knew everything, free and voluntary, I mean, all of it. And so there was no doubt that they dotted the I's and crossed the T's at the time the document was signed, it was fair, everyone knew everything. In divorce court, then that can be undone. Is that what you're suggesting?
Sure it can. Any agreement can be undone by any parties prior to the execution of the divorce under the guise of 767-255-3 if it's inequitable at the time of the divorce. The Button case talks about, I look at the Button case as two things. Number one, if you didn't know what you're getting into, we're not going to bind you to it. And also that if circumstances change so dramatically that it's just not fair anymore, we're not going to put our stamp of approval on it. So I think you can do that. I think you can have the agreement that you have talked about, and if circumstances have so changed, I think that you can go to the divorce court and say, this is no longer equitable and this shouldn't happen. The example that I use for my clients on a regular basis involving second marriage situations is, what if you have children? What if you adopt two or three kids? Do you think you're going to be able to say, you don't have any right to any of the stuff in my house anymore? What if you're married 20 years versus 2 years? It would be easier for me to go in and tell the judge, circumstances haven't changed, if neither of those children appeared or the circumstances involving the length of the marriage. Or someone becomes seriously ill. So those are all issues that can be reviewed by a judge, and I think those can all allow the judge to take that marital agreement you've described and say, I'm not going to be a party to enforcing it, where the end result is going to harm a person to such a degree, or it's not fair.
Does this agreement fit under 807.05? It was signed by both people?
No.
Why not?
Because 767.10 trumps 805.07, because it says specifically...
It's not 805.07, it's 807.05.
Oh, I'm sorry, Justice. I knew I was going to do that, so I wrote it down, but I don't have it in front of me.
I know, but you just transposed the numbers. I understood that. It's 807.05.
807.05.
It says, no agreement, stipulation, or consent between the parties or their attorneys in respect to proceedings in an action or special proceeding shall be binding unless, and the only one it would come under is made in writing and subscribed by the party to be bound thereby or the party's attorney. Wasn't this subscribed by the parties?
Yes.
So theoretically, it fits under 80705 as an agreement.
No, I don't think so, because it was executed after divorce, so
okay,
the specific statute.
This is nothing to do with it. It's just defining stipulations, that's all.
I do not believe it is under the way, if you define a stipulation under 80705, it is a stipulation under that.
That's
under
all
that
I'm asking you. Okay.
Statute.
Because it's signed by the party to be bound.
Yes, it was signed and subscribed because it was notarized.
And it's agreement, stipulation, or consent. So it really doesn't matter whether you label it agreement, stipulation, consent. None of this is binding unless it's recorded in open court or it's subscribed by the party. Okay. No problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Carroll, you have 5 minutes. We've got
him. Thank you. I'd like to make a couple of very brief comments. First of all, Chief Justice Abrahamson, with regard to your questions about whether the record supported the issue of whether or not there was an exemption because of the children, that's clearly in the record. The court basically just skirted that entire issue.
It what?
They just the trial court bypassed that entire issue. It's in its analysis. Similarly, with respect to, I believe it was Justice Bablich that mentioned the question of whether there's enough in this record. I don't believe there is. And the Court of Appeals did not get into enough detail.
Okay, on that subject,
yes.
I'd like to give us your best shot. Assume that you are writing this opinion, and you are writing it to say that the judge erroneously exercised his discretion, which is what you want us to say. Because if we find otherwise, you lose under whatever. What is your best shot as to why the judge erroneously exercised his discretion?
Well, of the three-prong test, he only made findings as to one prong.
The three-prong test under the marital property agreement, or?
Well,
under 767?
Yeah, in the case law that interprets that, the finding of inequity, I just don't believe there's enough in the record to meet either of those three prongs of the test. And the Court of Appeals seemed to just say, because the judge said the magic words, that he made a finding of...
What are the three prongs that are around there, please?
I'm sorry, they are...
I can find them.
Fair and reasonable disclosure, free and voluntary execution, and substantive fairness.
And the judge only found as to one?
Essentially that it wasn't free and voluntary execution. And there's no dispute that there was disclosure. Financial disclosure statements were on file, and that wasn't even mentioned. And in turn, there was no analysis done on the fairness. In fact, it ended up being unfair to the petitioner because he ended up receiving everything, essentially, in the court. I think that's pretty much all I wanted to say, except for a couple of things that I think are important. I think that the respondent is reading too much into what 767.10 is. This was not a stipulated divorce. It was a heavily contested divorce on all issues. The only issue that was stipulated to was the custody issue. 767.10 is a statute which just tells a judge who's about to grant a divorce that you have to approve any stipulations that come before you. It's not a statute that we can use to establish a bright line rule that says we're not going to review anything that the court doesn't approve. That's essentially what they're saying. And what that does is it prevents judicial review of what courts do on the other statutes. It makes absolutely no sense. You couldn't have review as long as the judge said, I'm not going to approve this. And it seems to me that that is somewhat of a simplistic view of what that statute provides for.
We would have to overrule Evenson to hold for you, would we not?
I believe I just wanted to say that the Divorce Reform Act of 1977, the cases cited by them predate that act. So these statutes have not been interpreted So I don't think that those cases are entirely controlling here. With respect to Evenson...
That's a 99 case.
Right. That, I'm not referring to that case. I'm referring to Ray and...
Evenson relies in part on Ray.
What I'm asking the court to do here is to interpret Ray in such a way, in each particular case, you look at whether the document is either a contract or a stipulation in the particular circumstances of each case. We had a trial in this case. Obviously, this was not a stipulation. So we're just asking you to for a ruling that says that 767.10 doesn't control in every situation. It has to be reviewed under the facts and circumstances of each case to determine if it's a stipulation or a contract. And if it's a contract, then it's subject to the other requirements in the, of these other statutes. And that's really all we're asking you to do. 767.255.3L is a limitation on the Ray holding. And the determination of whether this is a contract or a stipulation is just common sense, I think, under the circumstances and what happened in the trial court. So that rather than this bright line approach where we were denying people the right for judicial review of trial court decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Thank you, Mr. Van Rieselt. That ends our hearing on 99.